Hello and welcome back to Unseen Incidents. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we are picking the best player in every position so far this season. Then we're opening up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we are answering your questions, including Liverpool's shot at the Champions League and their squad building, about managers and how the role has changed over the last 20 years, and our ranking of Nepo babies, as well as the Brooklyn Beckham drama. That's all on today's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for more Unseen Incidents. Pete Dorman, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Happy to be here. Doing this on a Tuesday night instead of a Wednesday night. It's kind of throwing off my week a bit. I'm a little bit out of whack.
Yeah.
Unexpected first day in the office of the week and then rushing home in the middle of what is meant to be a name storm, but it seemed pretty normal in London.
Yeah, I can't even hear the rain or wind where I am.
I was expecting much worse, the fact that I woke up to a Met Office warning, risk of life. I imagine other places in the country are hit significantly worse, but strange Tuesday evening for us to be. I'm not sure if we've ever done it. The fact that we've recorded probably 60 or 70 times since this podcast started, I imagine one of them will have been a Tuesday. But this is quite unusual for us.
Yeah, I mean, look, this week we've got the Champions League final match of the league phase on Wednesday. So I'm going to need to be on, what's it called? What's the goal show thing, the whip round goal thing?
It's like Horncastle and stuff. Is he still on that?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm, sometimes he is. Like when you get Horncastle, in the days, when you get Horncastle and Richardson and Julien Laurent and all those guys, like that was elite.
Yeah.
I was like, all these guys.
People actually watch European football.
You would sometimes be watching footage where you had like Hönigstein. So you had like a German football expert, a French football expert, two Italian football experts. And two of those guys were also English. So they were talking about the Premier League as well. And you were just like, except for Spanish football, everything is represented here. Mm. And then sometimes you're like, oh, we get Rio Ferdinand.
Yeah.
The fucking thickest man ever to walk the earth.
I do think the general public prefer the gammon ex-British pro. I don't know why, but I just think they prefer. I think they get lost with Hönigstein and et al.
I don't know if that's true of the people who are watching the goal show. I think those people are just, you know, watching Chelsea. They're just like, who are the Chelsea playing today? That's all they care about. They're like, Chelsea, we're going to Kazakhstan. What kind of fucking place is that? Like that, those kind of guys, yeah, they're like, what does Rio think? He's won it all. But everybody else, I think, is kind of like, if I'm watching that show, at least make it not hard on my ears.
I've never had any real draw to the kind of goal show type shows, if I'm honest. It feels very American, and I don't feel I'm getting a great experience of actually what's happening. It's just, oh, a goal's gone in, here's the goal, and then go to another one.
Yeah, but that's great when there's a week where there's no game you really care about. And also, Pete, when you cover football professionally, as we in fact do, it's good to be able to just skip all the nonsense. No one cares about build-up, Pete. Nobody cares about tactics. They just want raw net-busting action. It's just all money shots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I was about to say something over my comment.
Yeah, I know. Every now and then I think, no. We want more female listeners. Yeah. Well, look, should we get into it then? Because what we thought we'd do today is go through each position and pick our players who we think have been the best in those positions this season. I've gone exclusively Premier League. I know there are a couple of other guys outside the league you want to talk about just to diversify it. But fundamentally, this is about the Premier League season so far. We also have simplified it. So rather than having right back and left back, we've got full back. Rather than having CM and DM, which might technically be true, but is a bit woke, we've just got CM. Midfielder. So there are guys who score the goals. There are guys who score the goals. There are guys who stop the goals, and there's some guys in the middle who do some other stuff. Yeah. We've got the guys in the middle, and we've got wingers. You know, we've tried to keep it fairly simple. So yeah.
We've got attacking midfielders as well, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Fair enough. Should we go back to front? Like, I guess we can. That way, we're going to end on a really
obvious one.
Obvious one.
Yeah.
Well, maybe let's get that one out of the way first. Should we just start with striker?
Yeah, we can start with striker and then go bottom to top after that.
Exactly. So striker.
Yeah.
That you could argue you, if you really, really want, you can make an argument for Igor Thiago, right?
In terms of like the level in which he's performing and scoring versus the level people expected him to, yes.
And also the level he's scoring on a team that is overperforming, that is not one of the elite clubs, where he doesn't exactly get incredible service. And also in a season where no other strikers in the league are performing. You know, people were talking about Ollie Watkins. I think Ollie Watkins might have 8 league goals, something like that. No strikers have been scoring a lot of goals this season. That is just simply the case. If you look down the Premier League list of top
Watkins
scorers.
Has 8 league goals,
Arsenal, top scorers are 5. Watkins has 8. And Mbeumo has 8. Ekitike has 8. Newcastle's top scorer 16. Is Bruno Guimaraes. Antoine Semenyo is on 10. So there are 3 players in the league on double figures. It's Haaland, Thiago, and Antoine Semenyo. And for
there
Thiago
are also
to
big
be do-
incremental drops between them as well.
Yeah, for Thiago to be doing that for Brentford is pretty phenomenal. Because I also think that people have been dramatically underestimating how hard it has got for strikers this season. We are seeing shots down. We are seeing touches down. A high percentage of goals are being scored from set pieces. And it seems like teams have decided to play more conservatively, knowing they have set pieces available to them. So maybe part of it is that Brentford are still actually trying to get service to their striker. But Thiago is really sticking them away. Haaland is the only guy who's been involved in more goals than Igor Thiago. Igor Thiago's on 17, Haaland's on 24. but really, there are very, very few players who are putting up big numbers this season. So I really want to give him credit for that. At the same time, 5 pens.
5 penalties. But he's actually over...
But you take those penalties out and he's still in double figures.
Yeah,
so, 11. I mean, you've got to give credit.
He's actually very, according to the understat, he is actually slightly underperforming his XG as well. 16.5 XG, 11.9 non-penalty XG.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's... I don't really know. I'd kind of want to take a look at the shots he's getting there. It feels like quite often he does well to get a shot away and you don't really know how good a chance it is. It might be a good position, but also we're living in a world now where the quality of available data has kind of gone backwards.
Yeah, I noticed that last week.
Admittedly, it's always Opta's numbers who've gone into FBref, but at the same time, you do wonder sometimes what a difference it would make to get pressure data, for example.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he's having a fantastic season. At the same time, Erling Haaland has just been banging them in.
Yeah.
He has been astonishingly good as a goal scorer. You can argue there are other questions here. So you could make the argument that does Haaland's brilliance lead City to make decisions that actually are not optimal? Because City are still heavily not favoured to win the league this season. They've obviously had some bad games in the Champions League as well. Arsenal fans are very angry that Arsenal haven't capitalised on City's mess-ups to be 9 points clear or whatever right now. But at the same time, you can say, well, Arsenal have messed up the last few games and City have not been able to reel them in, really. They're still 4 points away at the end of January because they themselves have been really unreliable. Now, that's not Haaland's fault exactly, but at least with someone like Thiago on Brentford, you're like, Thiago makes Brentford better. Haaland makes City better, but I also think this version of City, this City that revolves solely around Haaland, is nowhere near the level that we've seen in City teams in the past.
I agree, but I don't think that that's necessarily a stick you can beat Erling Haaland with because he's in that system that exists above his head. He's given a role and he's performing that role spectacularly well.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of like a corporate performance review, the failure of the team is one thing and it's not caused by Erling Haaland. It might be caused by the system that has to have been built around him, but I think him from an individual performance perspective is undeniably the best striker in the Premier League this season.
Yeah, nobody is really getting shots in volume this season, but he is. Nobody is scoring goals in volume, but he is. We'll come onto this later on when we get to wingers, but really, there has been a dramatic decrease in the kind of shots that people are getting. And yet Haaland, I believe, is still at around 4 shots per 90.
Yeah, just over.
Yeah, whereas the number of players who are over 3 shots a game this season, like we've got Haaland on 4. We've got Cunha on 3.7. Then we've got Šeško on 3.3. Ekitike on 3.2. Then you've got Hakpo on 3.1. That's the entire list of players taking more than three shots a game this season who have played over 1,000 minutes. Now, Wilson Isidore is very, very close. A couple of players are very, very close. But that's kind of insane.
Yeah.
And Haaland is not only still getting a decent number of shots, he's actually getting an excellent number of shots.
Yeah. And two of them are on target, and the quality of the shots is roughly double that of league average. Like, everything about this is just fantastic. His non-penalty XG is like over 0.8, best in Europe for anybody who's played over 900 minutes. Like, only Mbappe and Kane have a higher expected goals per 90, but they have 7 and 6 penalties respectively. Haaland is 2, but you know, his non-penalty XG is just so much greater than anybody else in Europe who's qualifies numbers or minutes wise. Yeah, he's just been an undeniable force this season.
Okay, well, should we move on from striker then? Because striker is boring. And should we go all the way back to goalkeeper? Who have you got in goal?
I have Robin Roofs.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because Sunderland are having a fantastic season, or they've had a fantastic start to the season. They are on 33 points after 23 games, over 1.4 points per game. Mm-hmm. Current pace puts them at like 55 points. I had Sunderland going down. You didn't. You were quite bullish on them. I believe a lot of the people at Transfer Flow were the exact opposite. Obviously, that's not panned out for me very well. But one of the reasons why Sunderland have been so good is because of how brilliant Roofs has been at the start of the season.
Yeah.
He's been huge for them. He's got 7 clean sheets, beaten only by 5 goalkeepers, 3 of which are in the big 6. Top 5 for save made, save percentage, goals prevented. Highest performance rating of any goalkeeper on StatMuse, which, again, I don't love to use those kind of random website-based ratings of players, but still, it's a good... To be top of the list, you're doing something right, basically.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, he has been one of the biggest reasons as to why Sunderland have been so good. Why Sunderland are like completely, even if in a world where the three relegation candidates were the three teams in 18th, 19th, and 20th weren't quite as bad as they are, especially 19th and 20th. Even if it was a closer, tighter bottom end of the table where 5, 6, 7 teams could feasibly go down, at this stage, Sunderland would still be safe because of how good the first half of the season was. And he conceded 26 goals, but from 37 expected goals against, so he's 11.5 over performance there in terms of what you expect the underlying numbers and the chances that Sunderland are giving up for him to concede. Biggest over performance in the league in terms of goalkeeping ability and shot stopping and goal prevention. His open play goal difference as well is -3, but his expected open play goal difference is -13.5. So this is a guy who's basically, and obviously there are other factors here in that the players around him can also affect those numbers, but realistically, the goalkeeper plays a huge part in this. And in any kind of expected goals against, open play or otherwise, versus actual goals conceded by him, he is substantially, and I think in both of those metrics, league leading in overperformance so far this season. And yeah, I think like there were a number of reasons why I didn't love Sunderland coming up and thought that they would struggle. A lot of their transfers have hit, and this is one of them that's hit like really, really well. And yeah, I think for me, there are other keepers that have had good seasons so far, but for me, based partly on the expectation of the team and kind of coming into the league pretty unknown as well, fast forwarding 23 games now, and for them to be sitting, where are they in the table? Like 10th? 10th, 11th? Pretty, completely safe for next season, and having had a real kind of hot streak from the start of the season through to just before Christmas, he's been a huge part of that. And I think just the unexpectedness of it tips him for me, as well as just, you know, I do think he's performed fantastically. I'm arguably better than any other keeper, but even if it gets close, I just think I like the story of it, which kind of puts him in my favor a little bit more.
Yeah, I think he's been an amazing signing for them. And we've talked a little bit before about his profile, and it feels like he should be a keeper they can hang onto. Well, I suppose a bunch of top teams are thinking more about shot stopping and less about distribution, so maybe they will come round to him, but he's not quite as sexy a name as a lot of other, as the kind of goalkeepers who can ping a pass onto the foot of a winger at the other end of the pitch.
We're seeing Spurs linked to him, but...
Okay. The guy I've got, I've got a different name. I think we're going to align on a lot of names.
But yeah,
we've got to be honest
I reckon
about
so.
It. But I've tried not to look at your names before I've done it. But my goalkeeper is Emi Martinez.
Sure.
And it pains me to say this because he's such a dreadful man.
Yeah.
but he has been incredible. Villa have allowed 25 goals from 36 expected goals. So their actual number of goals conceded is third best in the Prem. Their XG conceded is 14th in the Prem. That is such a huge... We've talked about them as you know, bangers FC, who are constantly scoring from outside the box. But this is really the difference in what's going on with Villa. The only person who gets close to that overperformance is Roofs for Sunderland. Yeah. And I actually think as well that Sunderland probably... They definitely protect Roofs better than Villa protect Martinez. Sometimes Villa will sit deep, but you generally do get space against Aston Villa. They're just not a particularly good defensive side. I think attackers probably get clearer looks against him. And as a result, some of the shots that we say, well, that's, you know, a 5% chance that he's facing, I wouldn't be surprised if they're slightly better than that. But he really does come up big. You know, look at this weekend. This weekend, they got another result against the odds where they produced, I think, something like 1.2 XG and allowed something like 2.2 away at Newcastle. But he makes a couple of incredible saves, one from Miley, one from Tonali. He's also an above average distributor, of course. And as a result, Villa get the result. And now they're extremely hard to catch in the Champions League spots. They're probably a result or two away from locking up third, realistically. You know, if you're in amazing form and you're 8 points off and there are 15 games left, it's just about possible that you could catch that side because they've got quite a tough schedule left.
Yeah.
And
the team you're pointing off are United, who...
And United are better than them, and Liverpool are better than them, but are they that much better than them now?
10 points across 15 games is tough.
Probably not. Probably not. There's no wiggle room there.
Yeah.
And so if Villa get another result when those teams don't, and I think that United will face some different challenges over the coming weeks. They've got Fulham up next.
Mm.
It'll be interesting to see if the stuff they've tried against City and Arsenal, both teams, I think, allowing them to do that stuff a little bit, if that works as well against a side that is happy to play them for a draw, you know, where they're going to have to come out and play. That'll be a really different challenge. If they're great, then great. But if they're not, then, or even if it takes them two or three games to work out, then that's Villa sealed. And this is the kind of campaign that is not just a great campaign, but is potentially changing the future of the club. Martinez was linked with a move away last summer. I don't think anyone really got serious about it. But
do you think?
There was real talk that he could go.
Yeah, I felt it was closer than maybe you, I think.
It was just as soon as I saw a price that said something like £50 million, I thought, no one's doing that. Like, Man United are not doing that, and Man United were the only team seriously linked. But anyway, he stayed, and he's only got like 6 clean sheets or whatever, but I don't think that's really down to him. The other thing that's amazing about him, by the way, is his record in penalties. He's faced one penalty this season. He saved it. Since he's been at Aston Villa, the last 5 seasons he's been at Aston Villa, he's faced 25 penalties in the league and he saved 5 of them. So those are ones he's actually saved as well. You know, it's though that does not include ones that have been missed. So often when we talk about, you know, a keeper against penalties, we include the ones that are missed. But he saved 5 of them and another one was missed. That's kind of remarkable.
Mm.
That gives you an edge immediately. I think that's really impressive. And look, I just hate the man, but he's had a great season. Aston Villa are going to get Champions League football because even if they get caught by 2 of those teams, they're certainly not going to get caught by 3 teams. It's just not going to happen. I'll be amazed if any of those sides catch them. A great season for him, man. Should we go on to fullback?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, fullback up next. I might carry on.
Yeah, I think so. Because I think we're going to agree on this.
It's a tough one though, right? And I think that, I don't know if you found this, but as I was going through positions, I thought, oh, there are a bunch of candidates here. Oh, wait, these ones haven't played. These have played out of position. These have got loads of XG but have underperformed or whatever it is. Fullback, I think, is similarly, it's difficult because there aren't really 2-way fullbacks in the Premier League anymore.
No.
You know, who have great... Earlier on in the season, like Truffaut or someone might have been in with a shout of this. I think Nico Riley, you could maybe talk about.
But, I have a lot of time for him.
But City's defence is also not that good. And while you said before about Haaland's been given a job and he just has to do it and the quality of the team overall is not really his concern. When it comes to defenders, it does feel a bit like we have to factor in the quality of defence.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you're an amazing defender, your defence will probably be at least okay, or at least your influence on it will be good. I think City across the season have, for large parts of it, had a very shaky and questionable defence.
Mm.
Making it, like, I had the same issue with players like Guardiola. I think he's a fantastic player, but it's difficult to make a case for him at centre back for the exact same reason.
Yeah.
I even went as far as considering shoehorning Szoboszlai into this conversation here because of how fantastic he's been this season, but he's kind of been a he's fallen foil to the fact he's been used in so many different positions. Yeah. It's difficult to nail him down to one position. So if I've not selected him in any of these positions.
Exactly. I'm in that same position where
because,
I think...
Because there's nowhere... He's not played one place enough. He's only. I think he's only started four games at right back. So it's hard to make that argument, even though he has been fantastic everywhere he's played. Mm. He's just kind of fallen foil of being so versatile. But yeah, I kind of wanted to shoehorn Szoboszlai in here because it felt like at least... If you get him in somewhere, it's reflective of him being so good this season. But ultimately, I just couldn't make the case for it based on just volume alone and time spent in that position versus the player who I ended up selecting, which I think will be the same player that you select.
Mm. I agree about Szoboszlai. I think that if I could have one honourable mention, it would be Szoboszlai.
Yeah.
I definitely agree. This is a guy who, in every position that he's played this season, might be top five in the league. But is he top one in any of them? Hard to say because he hasn't played there consistently. But yeah, Nico O'Reilly I considered, and of course Reece James has played a lot of central midfield, so it didn't feel fair either. In the end, I had to go Urien Timber.
Yeah,
and I thought I'm probably going to end up picking quite a lot of Arsenal players here, but at the same time, Arsenal are top of the league and
with the best defense in Europe,
and one of the best defenses we've ever seen. I mean, it's getting all this stuff at the moment about, you know, playing Man United from 2007-08. I just think, if you believe that you can compare teams from different eras, then more power to you. But I don't think you could do that. But I think that now they've conceded more goals, obviously, than the great Mourinho team. But this is the best defensive side I've seen since in the Premier League, since I really started following football very, very seriously again in about 2011. You know, the only side I've seen come close to this is the Tuchel Chelsea team. And their best defensive performances were in the Champions League when they won it. We haven't seen a side at this level, really. Okay, the one side we've seen is we saw one Man City team that conceded, I think, 23.8 XG in their best season.
Was that the Centurion season?
I think so. Or it might have been the one after. But so that was an amazing side. But that was in a weaker league.
Yeah.
Timber, last season, I think we'd have said he's too defensive. You know, this is a great defensive fullback, but that's all it is. At the same time, it's hard to separate what he does in build-up, his movement, his passing, to separate that from how a team plays further up the pitch. But that would have been the knock against him, right? What is his influence in the final third? He is not as good there as Ben White.
Yeah.
But this year, 5 goal involvements, and he's really improved at seeing when to drive towards the box, making runs into danger, overlapping, underlapping, playing passes into the penalty area. He's won a penalty this season for Arsenal as well. There are a few players who are allowed to cross at Arsenal, and he's one of them. He's kind of fourth or fifth. I think he's fourth on the list of crosses from open play this season, which is quite unusual. Arsenal don't use their fullbacks to do that as a general rule.
Mm.
And he does succeed at fundamentally the basic job of the fullback, which is how hard is it to attack Arsenal through that flank? It's incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Unless I'm missing someone really obvious, and I can't think who I would be missing, who is a better defensive fullback in world football at the moment than Urien Timber? There might be someone, but I just can't think of them. Real Madrid don't have a better defensive fullback. Neither do Barcelona. Inter play with wingbacks and are not super defensive. Bayern. But Bayern don't have a lockdown defensive fullback. It's genuinely quite hard to work it out. Who are the elite fullbacks? So I think,
yeah,
I think
fair point.
I think by default it sort of ends up being him, and it feels a little bit uninspiring, this one, but fundamentally you're playing for the best defense in the league, you're top of the league, and you've been involved in 5 goals. That's a pretty good season for a fullback.
Yeah, he has one less non-penalty goal than Gyökeres. He's the same amount of total goal involvements than Gyökeres. From we thought was too defensive.
I've only got five goals fewer than Gyökeres. I'm right up there.
Yeah, but also only like Eze, Mourinho, Trossard, Saka and Rice have more non-penalty goal involvements than Timber this season. A guy who we would have criticised.
I'm closer to Gyökeres' goal involvements than he is to Thiago.
Sure. But,
at Brentford.
Right, sure. But I think you say it's kind of a little bit uninspired. I think that is perhaps a little bit unfair on Timber. I think he's been fantastic.
But you know what I mean? He's not like Marcelo, is he? You know, he's a very good defensive fullback.
I just don't think the level of quality at fullback is really that deep anymore. I think there are some very good specialist players in those roles. Mm. Either like a very uninspired, like I am just a Gary Neville type fullback, or I am basically a winger like Frimpong.
Mm.
And I think it's becoming increasingly more rare to find a player like Timber who is two-way, who is versatile. He can play anywhere across that back line, anywhere across that back six he can play.
He's played centre back, right back, left back this season.
And you can put him in a six if you want, if you'd like add a push, yeah, if you need to. He'd be fine.
Well, I mean, you can do what you want, but is it advisable? No. I was going to say something that I knew would make people angry, but I was going to say, you know what? He's just like Ashley Cole. And I think that a lot of people are like, Ashley Cole was one of the greatest fullbacks of all time. Ashley Cole was good. He was a good fullback. He was a good defensive fullback. He had next to no impact in attack, but he would motor up and down the flank and people like that. But you're right. That kind of fullback, the fullback who just patrols the entire flank, the only teams who play with those fullbacks now are teams who either play with a back three or teams that are crap. Like, nobody does that seriously anymore, where they expect the fullback to just get up and down the wing relentlessly. It simply does not happen. And as a result, you know, you're a little bit less eye-catching when instead of racing up the wing, making an underlapping run, putting a cross into the box and getting the assist, you are instead tucking into midfield and providing a solid rest defense. But having Timber there is like having a good central midfielder. And I do think that I've said this a lot of times, but I do think he has probably the most game intelligence in the Arsenal squad, maybe in the whole squad, because so often when you
see
him
in the back,
that's hard to say.
Saka's also intelligent as well.
But Saka's got a simpler role,
sure,
right? Saka doesn't have to organize others. Odegaard does have to do that. I think it's difficult to say, maybe,
yeah,
but Timber, next time you watch Arsenal play, watch Timber and you'll see there are times when he looks and he sees the space and he bursts into it. There are times when Saliba's on the ball and Timber will walk backwards until he's deeper to allow Saliba to push forwards when he sees that there's space for him. Mm-hmm. I think he's really good at noticing those sorts of things and watching how space appears on the field. He's just an excellent player that you never really need to worry about.
Yeah.
And coming out of the Eredivisie, that's kind of insane. Yeah, he's just been excellent this season, and he could end the season with no trophies, but Arsenal are in the semi-final of the Carabao Cup. They're still in the FA Cup. They're top of the Premier League by 4 points. They've been by far and away the best team in the Champions League. It would not be crazy if Arsenal ended the season with two major trophies.
Yeah, it wouldn't.
So we will see. If they don't end up with those, then I guess that maybe we might revise our opinion of Timber. But he's had a really good season. And to go on to centre-back, I'm going to guess that we're staying at the same club.
We are. I've actually selected both. I say you can take your pick because
I've chosen.
Yeah, I think the obvious answer is Gabriel because I think he's a better player this season and a better player currently. I think Saliba's ceiling is astonishingly high, and the player Saliba will become will be truly incredible. But yeah, I think either of these are viable picks.
Oh, by the way, last point on that. Timber is 24.
Yes, insane, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing I forgot. I was like, he must be 26. And then I looked it up and he's 24. So sorry, you were saying. See, I don't agree that Gabriel is a better player this season. I think Saliba is a better player this season. But I would make the argument for Gabriel because in the clutch moments, he has been big for Arsenal this season. Like 5 goal involvements.
Yeah, so you're literally coming down to his aerial prowess and set pieces.
No, not just in attack. I think if you look at Saliba plays a bigger role in build-up, right?
Yeah.
But if you look at who makes the most clearances in the team, who makes the most blocks in the team, who is the guy who actually... Because Saliba's quite a quiet centre-back, I would say. If you look at the guy who's actually organising the defence when it comes to facing set pieces of the other sides, when it comes to trying to rally them after, you know, a bad mistake, it is Gabriel. Gabriel is the one who does it. And actually, his XG last season was at 0.21. Expected goals and assists per 90 minutes, which was already crazy for a centre-back. This season, he's at 0.3. It's insane. He's like a good
attacking midfielder.
Or at least a good central midfielder who's getting forward a lot, right? I think Gyökeres is at 0.4. I think Odegaard this season is at 0.37. It's insane. And Arsenal, he's appeared 17 times in the league this season. And in the time he's been on the field, Arsenal have allowed 9 goals. Let that sink in. 9 goals.
Yeah, he's played 1,500 minutes.
That is insane. So if only his goals counted, Arsenal would only have a -4 goal difference if only his goals counted in the time that he's been on the pitch. Isn't that nuts?
Yeah.
I just think it's ridiculous. And he seems to have almost completely eliminated the stupidity from his game as well. And even when he isn't the guy getting the goal and assist, there are so many set piece goals that Arsenal have had this season that were not scored or assisted by Gabriel, but that are traceable to the fact that when Gabriel is there, everyone shits themselves. He's just such a scary prospect.
Gabriel has the fourth highest XG per 90 of at Arsenal of anybody who's played over 1,000 minutes this season in the Premier League.
There are a bunch of guys who are just not at the minutes, right? You know, like Marino is just off 1,000 minutes, and Madueke and Martinelli would be higher as well.
500.
But you've got...
We're comparing this to centre-back.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane.
If you drop it to 500 minutes, he's sixth. Marino gets up there. Only Marino gets up there. Martinelli gets up there as well.
Yeah.
But still.
It's pretty crazy. And on top of that, he's just a really good defender. You know, that Villa game that Arsenal lost away, that was the game where they had neither Saliba nor Gabriel, and they played two guys who've never played together at centre-back.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave up, the first shot they gave up in that game was the biggest chance they'd given up in the season to date at that point. And I think remains one of the biggest chances. That, I guess the Watkins one at the Emirates, but that was when the game was over. It was 4-0. And actually, I think Gabriel had been substituted when that one went in. So he's been sensational, and in the Champions League as well. And Arsenal have been, I know that people don't like this, and I know that we're coming off this bad result against Man United, but Arsenal have been the outstanding team in every competition they've played this season.
Yeah.
And
I don't think there's an argument against
that. Why is that? It's because of their defence.
Yeah. In the Premier League, they've conceded over one expected goal in five of their games so far. Five of their games, they've conceded more than one XG. And
okay.
They've only conceded more than one goal in three Premier League games overall.
Yeah, and even this United game at the weekend.
There was like 0.7 XG, and they conceded
0.7 XG. And what can you do about that? Yeah. I mean,
Patrick Dorgu, like the finishes from Dorgu and Cunha are just fantastic finishes. Like,
yeah, I mean, the Dorgu one, you cannot do anything about.
No.
And it's not the centre back's job. The Cunha one, there should have been a midfielder there.
They're like, yeah, exactly. And it's still a good finish that once that chance falls to Cunha and he hits it the way he did, like as soon as that ball left his foot, you knew it was in.
Well, you know, you say, well, that's Raya's job. You know, Raya's the only guy who has a shot of stopping this becoming a goal.
But I mean, but the way he hit it with the bend on it.
I know. I'm not criticizing Raya, when a player puts a strike on a ball like that from that kind of distance, that's not a bad outcome for a defence, for a guy to be taking a shot on from basically from like 30 yards.
Yeah,
I'd say that's why we have a goalkeeper. His job is to save that. And if he doesn't save it, okay, sometimes that happens. But I don't put that blame on the defence. Anyway, look, we had to have a couple of Arsenal defenders in here, and the defence has been astonishingly good. Moving into central midfield, so here there's some variety. And I think that you've probably gone... There are guys I left out because I thought you might go for them.
There's a guy I left out that was potentially first on my list. It was the first person that came to mind. Maybe the second person that came to mind. No, but a guy I avoided because I think you're going to go for him. So I've broken this down to central midfielders and attacking midfielders.
Yeah, I've got attacking midfielders separate
from
central
midfielder. Okay, so we'll just do the kind of deeper central midfielder, yeah.
Central midfielder is anybody who plays on that line, so a six, an eight, whatever.
Yeah, sure. I did consider Caicedo. But I guess we could talk about
six yellows and a red, two bans.
Yeah, but also 5.5 tackles and interceptions per 90, fourth in Europe, 91 tackles and interceptions overall, third most in Europe, most interceptions per 90 in Premier League, 2.4 per game. He is a very good player.
Oh no, he's been great, but I don't think that the yellows and the red are just his fault as well. I think it is probably a tactical issue. But I do look at that stuff and I think if Rice had two bans this season, that would make a big difference for Arsenal. And I think losing your best central midfielder would make a big difference to most teams. And Chelsea are very close to Man United, but they are behind Liverpool and Man United, right?
I think they're above Liverpool.
Are they above Liverpool?
They're within 3 points of each other, 2 points of each other. Yeah, they're just above. They're a point above Liverpool and a point behind United.
Okay, but I think we look at them and we say their goal difference is so much superior to these sides. Like they should be out of sight. And yet they are 9 away from Villa. Yeah, a point ahead of Liverpool, sure. I guess I just look at that and think, they got a point at home against Arsenal, which was the game Caicedo was sent off. Maybe if that hadn't happened. Sometimes you know, you would have lost that game because you'd have left more space playing at home if you had 11 men. But Arsenal looked pretty bad that day, and Chelsea might easily have beaten them. Like, there are games like that where you say, what would have happened if we'd got the extra 2 points then? Well, then you would be fourth. You know, there's yeah. this kind of thing, which I think it's at least reasonable to say, halfway through a season, to have had a ban for yellow cards and a red card is not great. And it's not bad luck. You do look at him in every game and I think, fuck, man, you are very aggressive. And you probably need to manage yourself a little better. When the game is getting scrappy, you need to be the calmest guy. Anyway, yeah. I consider him, and I also consider Bruno Guimarães. 8 goals for Newcastle, quietly did that. They obviously lost to Villa this weekend. Who was missing? Bruno Guimarães. He is fantastic.
Yeah. He didn't really land on my radar for... Basically, I ended up with three players. Bruno Guimarães wasn't one of them. One of them was a player I think you're going to talk about next. The other player, Elliot Anderson.
Yeah, okay.
Like,
so I'm glad you're talking about him because I decided not to, assuming you would.
I mean, this guy has just been fantastic this season. 3.8 tackles and interceptions per 90. Fifth most in Europe. Most completed passes of any midfielder in the league. 120 more than Zubimendi in second. Tons of passes in the final third. Only behind Szoboszlai and Wirtz. One possession back more than anyone else in the league. One with the most ground jewels of anyone else. Like, this guy is just kind of everything you want. You talk about Caicedo in that he's fantastic, but he should be the calmest person in that on the pitch in the scenarios that he gets himself into. I feel like Elliot Anderson is kind of that guy. He's great at disrupting play. He's great at passing. He's great at progressing the ball. He is just that kind of fantastic orchestrator from deep. And he's kind of come out of, I guess for most people, over the past couple of seasons, come out of kind of nowhere. Like, if you ask anybody who was Elliot Anderson 2 seasons ago, I'm not certain the layman on the street or in the pub would have been able to tell you, but I think everybody knows who he is now.
When we talked about him leaving Newcastle as this disaster, a lot of people said, who cares?
You know, exactly.
Newcastle will be absolutely fine. They've decided they don't need him. What's the problem? And imagine if they had Elliot Anderson and Yankuba Minte now. How good Newcastle would be.
Yeah. I mean, how much did he go for?
35, I think. It wasn't nothing. It was reasonable money. But he was highly rated even then. It wasn't like they sold a guy they didn't like. They sold him because of PSR.
Yeah.
But because they got themselves into a pickle with PSR.
I don't know why I laughed at the word pickle. But yeah, 23 years old, homegrown, a guy who is like one of the best Premier League midfielders.
He'll go to Man City.
Do you think?
He'll go to Man City for £100 million. He'll play as an 8 alongside Rodri, and then in the long term, he will become Rodri, and that will do them for, I think he's 23, right?
He's 23,
so,
yeah.
So that'll do them for 6 years, but maybe more. He'll be great. He's a great player.
He's also a November birthday, so he's only recently turned 23. Yeah, I think he's a great player, fantastic season, great profile, does everything you want him to do in that position, and has a long career ahead of him, and is homegrown as well, which is kind of worth its weight in gold as well.
Yeah, he looks amazing, man. He looks absolutely amazing. But is he Declan Rice?
See, this is the person I've ordered. It was the first person that came to mind, but I knew that you would do it, and I also just didn't want to rim Arsenal too much.
I tried to avoid Rice, and I didn't want to go into Arsenal too much, but at the same time, I was kind of like, they are top of the league.
Yeah, yeah.
And Declan Rice is their best central midfielder. He's got 7 goal involvements in the league. Only Trossard has more at Arsenal. He is the top Arsenal player for ball winning. He's the top central midfielder in the league for progressive carrying. He's obviously a huge threat when it comes to taking set pieces. There are 3 players at Arsenal who have more expected goals and assists per 90 than his 0.4 among guys with 1,000 plus minutes. So, yeah, like we said, Madueke, Martinelli, Marino, all those guys would get in there if they had more minutes. But he is a fantastic passer. He is a fantastic defender. He is good in the air. He can cover the entire midfield late in games when Arsenal need a goal. He has played right back at certain points, stepping into midfield. His best performance this season, you know, was not in the Premier League. It was probably that one against Bayern, where he was absolutely unplayable. But whenever he's there, there is a limit to how bad Arsenal can be. There is just a limit to how bad they can be. And even when you think about that third goal, you know, the weekend where it was, okay, Rice isn't there to cover. At the same time, it kind of bobbles around and breaks to Cunha kind of a little bit, luckily. But that was because Arsenal were looking for a goal. You know, so often in those games, I think, okay, Rice
It was like a little like squeeze through from Kobbie Mainoo that just fell.
Yeah, and I look at stuff like that and I think I don't really blame you for that. In the same way, I don't fully blame Caicedo for his yellows and reds. Not fully.
Okay.
Mostly, but not fully. So I think that often the times when Declan Rice looks worst are because of game state or something. You know, it's because the team's hunting for a goal.
Yeah.
And when Arsenal look really good, it's almost always that Declan Rice is playing really well. When he's there, it does feel...
But I kind of think that's similar to just that role, that position. If your central midfielder mm-hmm. is playing really well in any given game, you probably look quite good.
But we're talking about Caicedo as a contender for team of the season. How good do Chelsea look in most of their games? They look like dog shit in half their games. We're talking about Elliot Anderson as one of the best central midfielders in the league. Have Nottingham Forest been blowing your doors off this season? You know, even Newcastle haven't looked that good with Bruno Guimaraes. Yeah, I think you do what you can, but you've got to look at the role that they've been given. You've got to kind of try and figure out what their tactical instruction is and how well they're executing it. But Declan Rice he does have some of that N'Golo Kanté thing of feeling like you've got an extra half a player on the pitch. Because he is absolutely relentless and his recovery speed is insane and he's nimble and skillful, but also huge and strong. And, you know, again, if Arsenal win the league, this spine is going to be what it's about. Who protects that back line? Rice. Who takes the corners? Rice. Who drives the team forward? Rice. Who is often the guy arriving late in the box? Rice. He's getting goals as well. So I just think it's not like he's a perfect player, but as a central midfielder goes for this particular era of the Premier League, he is as close to perfect as it gets, I think. It's really hard to think of. Well, what do you need? Like this is a Premier League that is built at the moment around hard running, contesting aerial balls, mopping up loose balls, and being able to pass well when you see an opportunity.
Yeah, he is very multifaceted.
And set pieces. Those are all the things he's good at. What he's not going to do is, you know, pick a pass through two lines of pressure into the penalty area, but he's not an attacking midfielder.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Enzo Fernandez, I thought about Enzo Fernandez as well, but Enzo Fernandez has kind of played as an AM at times this season. And again, he's more attacking mm-hmm. than Rice. So his attacking stuff is, well, it's only as good because of Rice's prowess on set pieces. But Rice does all the normal central midfield stuff as well, I guess. That's my argument.
Yeah, no, I think he is. He's an undoubtedly fantastic player and is so good at mostly everything that you would want him to do in any scenario. And he's doing so at such a high rate for the best team in the world. It's quite difficult to not select him. I had to consciously not select him because I figured that we would end up agreeing on quite a few players. Because there are some standouts, but I reckon I wanted some variety. And also I figured that you would go with Rice. And also I'd done 2/3 Arsenal players already and I'd gotten bored of Arsenal, if I'm honest.
I think that's fair enough. And interestingly, we're going to end up with winger, which is, I think, the hardest position to pick. But before that, we've got attacking midfield. I think this is one we will agree on. Because, again, I was thinking, haven't been many great attacking midfielders this season. And then I thought, but if you actually look at the league, if you looked at the league in the summer, you'd have said, Arsenal have got Ødegaard and Eze, Liverpool have got Wirtz and Szoboszlai, Chelsea have got Palmer, Spurs have got Xavi Simons, Maddison and Kulusevski, Villa have got Rodgers, Grealish was off to Everton. You know, there were definitely a lot of people like Morgan Gibbs-White. You know, there are all these players, Damsgaard even, who you thought, oh yeah, these guys could have amazing seasons as attacking midfielders. And in the end, a bunch of them are playing out of position. Some of them are out of form. Some of them are injured. And so you end up with, some haven't had enough minutes, like Cherki.
But that means kind of wingery as well. Yeah.
That means that there's pretty much one undeniable pick here, I think.
Yeah, there is only one pick here. There literally is only one pick.
Yeah.
The only person that could rival this player is Martin Odegaard. And he's, you know, had his own issues this season.
Yeah. Up and down, really.
Yeah, it's like it's not been consistent enough and he's been in and out of the squad. He's got under 1,000 minutes and stuff. But it is just Bruno Fernandes. Like, it just is. Like, Bruno Fernandes has continued to be world-class regardless of all the noise at United. Most assists in the Premier League, most chances created from open play, highest expected assists, fourth highest expected assists from open play, like, most three balls in the Premier League. Everything you want from your attacking midfielder, Bruno Fernandes, has done that. And he's done it in multiple roles as well. Like, he actually hasn't even played a huge amount in like the traditional cam role that he's used to. He's played deeper. He's played beside Casemiro. He's played beside Ugarte at points. Obviously, Amrium's gone now. He's kind of playing in a more traditional 4-3-3, more advanced role that has that where he has less defensive responsibilities. But he's done all this by playing deeper. He's been huge in progression for United, and everything you expect and want from Bruno Fernandes, he's continued to do despite United being in this kind of weird Amorim transition period now in with Carrick. Bruno Fernandes has been the one constant through all of this. Last season, even before that, he just continued to be world class. And I just don't think it makes it clearer because of all of the circumstances around it, a lot of the other players you just mentioned, that it is undeniably Bruno Fernandes. But I think even if you remove all of those circumstances and say everybody that was available to play had a really good season or is having a good season so far, I think there's only like Palmer and Odegaard who would really have a legitimate chance of competing with like Bruno Fernandes' output so far this season.
Yeah, it's not that complicated. When you look at expected goals and assists per 90 this season, number one in the league is Haaland. Number two is Bruno Fernandes. He's right there level with Bukayo Saka.
Mm-hmm.
But Saka has underperformed expected goals. Bruno is just racking up goals and assists. He is. And of course, he's played central midfield a lot as well. He's got really good progressive passing numbers. He's also been a big ball winner for Man United. He's just been phenomenal. And people are now really excited. They're like, look, this is what happens when you put a guy in the right position. But the simple fact is he was looking excellent when he was playing in the wrong position as well.
Yeah.
And he was the only thing that... United have got a couple of big results since Amorim went, but they haven't actually really been better yet. We don't know how good they'll be. They already looked pretty good this season under Amorim. They were working in that setup, and Bruno Fernandes was the thing that was making them work. He's just, again, another player who could have left, right? He's taken or created 114... of United's 371 shots this season. So about a third of United's shots he has either
taken or created. Okay, yeah.
That seems quite a lot. He's got 12 goal involvements in his last 10 Premier League games. This is just a phenomenal player. And he's old. You know, he should not be able to be a cromulent central midfielder in this version of the Premier League at 31.
Yeah.
The way the Premier League is now, United especially trying to really up their second ball wins, you know, asking him to play a deeper role
it's
in midfield
a big
and still
grind-eating type it's role.
It is, and he's 31, and it would have been completely reasonable if he'd kind of been like, okay, I can do the deep passing or I can do the advanced passing, but I can't do both. And actually, instead, he's just done both. He has had a phenomenal season. Man United, given their underlying numbers and where they are, you'd have to give them really strong odds of making the Champions League because they've been better than Liverpool. They've been better than Chelsea. They've been better than Villa. They're not that far off City. They're not going to catch Villa or City probably. But if anybody did, it would be them. They just look good. It's not nailed on because, we're obviously saying this on the back of what they are under Carrick. And we're saying this off the back of two games where even in previous years, they might have done well in those games because United have always been good against teams that will come out against them and leave them space. They've always had the players to exploit that.
Especially also when they're coming into games with limited expectation as well. Like you go into that Arsenal game, you go into that City, you go into those two games and if you lose, nobody says, oh, that's a bad result. Everyone's like, well, yeah, we expected that. So I think United have always, or at least post-Ferguson, early in the last however many, I don't know, handful of years, when you take the pressure off United and there's limited expectations, they perform better. It's against the little teams or the teams that you're like, oh, you really should beat this team. And then that team kind of sits in, makes it really difficult and horrible to play against.
Mm.
That's when United have looked weak and struggled. They drop points against Wolves just before Amorim was sacked. You know, those are the games that I think under Carrick will actually really see what this system is and how viable and good it is. And I think will be a better showcase of how United will perform over the last 15 games of the season versus the two games we've just seen.
You look at some of these games and you're like, Fulham at home next. Fulham are going to be solid defensive.
Yeah.
They've got Spurs at home, God knows. West Ham away, easy. But Everton away, Palace at home, Newcastle away, Villa at home, Bournemouth away. You know, like these are Chelsea away. These are difficult games. Sunderland away. There are teams here who are set up to frustrate them. When I see them going against Brighton or something, I think, okay, yeah, that's a game you can win. But when I see them, you know, playing Forest, I think, ooh, I don't know about that. That's a difficult one. If they can win those games consistently, then you've got a really great situation. but it's still a question mark. And, you know, Dorgu, today they just announced that Dorgu's going to be out for about 10 weeks with a hamstring injury, which feels insane. I mean, it must be like a separation or something, because that's really, that's a long absence for a hamstring injury. But anyway, Bruno, winger, last position, I think this is one of the hardest ones, because again, as I say, this season, everybody's taken a step back. Everyone's underperforming. Like Bukayo Saka, I said he was kind of level with Bruno Fernandes on expected goals and assists. He's at like kind of 0.68, 0.69, something like that. Last season, he was at 1.01 expected goals and assists per 90 minutes. There are 12 players in the league this season with 1,000 minutes minimum and over 0.6 non-penalty expected goals and assists per 90. 12. Last season, there were 24. So it's halved.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think there are quite a lot of people underperforming, even those who have good expected goal and assist numbers. And I think you can't really give people credit, like team of the season type credit, for having amazing expected goal numbers, because part of performing is scoring your chances.
Yeah.
The reason we talk about expected goals is because we're generally trying to make predictions, right? So we're kind of, oh, well, this team is putting up a lot of expected goals versus their opponents. Therefore, we'd expect them to win games in the long run.
Over volume,
Everybody's saying this guy is playing like shit because he's missing all his chances, but actually he's getting in the positions and getting shots, and therefore we expect that the goals will come.
It's much better to get those chances than to not get those chances to miss.
Exactly. But at the same time, the guys we're going to give credit here, you know, who have been great this season, it doesn't matter if you've got the highest XG in the league, if you missed all your chances, like you actually do need to score. And so there are the guys who are just blasting in bangers, really overperforming XG, and I wouldn't put them in either. So I'm not going to put in Harry Wilson, you know, because I don't think he really does make his team better. Or he certainly won't make it better in the long term. They'd be better off with a player who creates more reliably. But I do think you want to balance those two. You want them to have good underlying numbers because that suggests that they're helping their team, and you want them to actually be putting those chances away. So then you're in the business of compromises, and then you think, Mbeumo, Semenyo, Leandro Trossard, someone like Saka is underperforming expected goals and assists, but he still does a lot for the team. I don't know. Like Cody Gakpo has really good underlying numbers, but hasn't really been putting them away.
Doku.
It should be Doku.
It should, yeah.
But he's only got 1,100 minutes and only got 5 goal involvements, and he's playing alongside Haaland. So there's no slam dunk. So I don't know. I don't know where you are with this, but I really, really struggled with this.
Yeah, I struggled so much that we didn't specify, at least it wasn't related to me, that this was just Premier League.
Sure.
So because it was so difficult in the Premier League, I went to Europe. I went to the Bundesliga and found Olise.
Okay.
Because his season's insane. But yeah, you're completely right in that when you look at all the performances from wide attacking players in the Premier League so far this season, there isn't really any significant standout for me. Nobody sits above the top of the rest, like Bruno Fernandes, nothing like that. But when you look at somebody like Olise, yeah, he's just absolutely cooking. He's got 10 goals and 14 assists in 1690s.
Sorry?
10 goals, 14 assists in the league in 1690s.
In 1690s?
1690s. Let me get how many minutes he's played. It's insane. He's at 0.72 expected assists per 90. Just assists. Literally double second place. And they're virtually all from open play as well. Most passes in the final third in the Bundesliga, 100 more than second place. Second most chances created in the Bundesliga. Like, he's just been an outrageous... Well, obviously, Bayern have been supernova this year. Harry Kane has been a big factor of that. But Olise has just slyly been outrageous. And yeah, I haven't heard a huge amount about him either. Like, yeah, people talk about Harry Kane's involvement. But yeah, 1,400 minutes, 10 goals, 14 assists in the Bundesliga this season, 4 shots per 90, 3 key passes per 90, over 3 key passes per 90. He's just been phenomenal, outrageous. And yeah, like I was looking for somebody in the Premier League. I wasn't expecting anywhere near those numbers, but I was expecting somebody to try and make an argument that they stand out a little bit more above everybody else, or all of the kind of just large collection of pretty good to very good attacking wide players we have in the Premier League. But nobody just really stood out for me, which is why I just kind of went a little bit further afield.
Yeah, fair enough. It's nice to give him some shine, given how ridiculous he is. But you're right. Sometimes when people talk about, oh, who are France going to play in their front line at the World Cup? And people say, oh, maybe it'll be Dembele and Mbappe and Mateta. And you're like, well, There is this guy who is one of the best players in the world now, and actually wants to play on the right side. Yeah, he's been incredible. In the Premier League, I think it's hard. And so in the end, I just picked a player I wanted to give some credit to, Kevin Schaarder.
Oh, okay.
Because I think early in the season, Brentford were on a lot of people's list as a team that could get pulled into the relegation battle. A lot of us were worried about them. They obviously promoted a PE teacher, and it was a big concern. And they looked pretty ropey at the beginning of the season. And now they're up to eighth. They're totally safe.
Yeah.
Ouattara and Thiago have been excellent as well. But Schaarder has really stepped up, especially over Christmas. He's got 9 goal involvements in the Premier League. He actually has a winning aerial record as a forward. But he's won more aerials than he's lost, which is... People always say, well, you pick the ones you can test, but all forwards do that and they still don't have winning aerial records. It's crazy. He gets very, very few shots, but very, very good ones. His dribbling has gone down this season as well because he's playing a slightly more advanced role, and also everyone's dribbling has gone down. I think that might mean that a bigger team doesn't come in for him, but I think he's an excellent player. He's 24 years old. He's also a huge defensive workhorse. If they keep Thiago and Ouattara and Schaarder... And to be honest with you, I don't know if anybody's going to go for any of those three. Maybe somebody will try and get Thiago, but if they do, they'll get a crazy, great, crazy money for him. But yeah. Schaarder is the kind of guy who maybe, you know, if Newcastle hadn't got Alanga last year, they probably would have thought about someone like Schaarder. Though I also don't think he'd be the right fit for them, but that is the kind of move they'd make. But if they end up with just a front four, I suppose, of Damsgaard, Schaarder, Ouattara, and Thiago... That's a really good attack for Brentford, man. So I don't think I'd really honestly argue he's been the best winger in the league, but I also would struggle if you told me I really had to pin myself to somebody. You know, Estevao has got under 700 minutes. Who do you go for?
Yeah. No, I fully agree. I think I probably would have let maybe to... I don't know.
Maybe Semenyo. I was going to say,
for me, probably potentially Semenyo.
Fair.
Like, Mbeumo was kind of difficult because he would have, in Amorim's, like, kind of two advanced midfielders.
Well, exactly.
They're quite narrow.
Sure.
So it kind of muddies the water there. Semenyo, for me, was the obvious one that you could potentially try and make an argument for. But we've spoken about before how, while his physical, tangible numbers are good, his underlying numbers aren't great. And, like, for everybody I found or looked at, there was always some reason or a handful of reasons to not pick them versus all of the other people on the list that we've spoken about. Most of the people were like undeniably, okay, there are too many reasons to not pick them. So yeah, I struggled with wide forwards. I think if I was gun to my head, I would go Semenyo from the Premier League. But yeah, I agree. I think there's been a weird like gap of like outstanding wide attacking play in the Premier League this season.
And I'll be interested to see if that changes by the end of the season. You know, if somebody like Saka or one of the Liverpool players...
I think Saka's the most likely.
...has really, you know, pushed themselves back into contention. Or Doku comes back in, plays all the time and gets a bunch of goals and assists. Or Semenyo starts to produce Man City level numbers. You know, that would also do it. But yeah, those are our players. And I'd be really intrigued to hear... People tell us if they think that we've missed anybody. Anyway, should we move on to the burn book? Okay, it's time for the burn book. Should we start with in or out, Pete? Do you want to go or shall I?
I'm going to start and I'm going to go with out.
Okay.
So what I'm going to take out of the burn book this week is chargeback.
Chargeback.
Okay. Credit card company chargeback.
Pretty Tory pick.
I mean, I've never used it before, but I recently used it. And I don't love credit cards. They're not great at the best time. I feel like as companies and as entities, they're pretty soulless and exploitative. And how people like ultimately ruin their lives by racking up debt with like crazy APRs. And then it just exponentially grows and they're just fucked. I always get served that kind of chubby guy with glasses who basically rips apart people's financial... Like people come to him being like, I'm in this amount of debt and these are my, they give him their finances basically, and they end up there, it turns out that they're paying like £2,000 a month or $2,000 a month for this stupid car when they, you know, are in insane amounts of debt that is just growing, and they're like, oh yeah, but it'll be fine. Some people are like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna win the lottery, I'm really committed to winning the lottery, and he just kind of rips them apart. It's quite morbid but fun to watch. But yeah, I don't love the whole prospect of credit cards generally, but also the system kind of feels a bit broken in that, like, to get good credit you need a credit card, and having good credit helps you get mortgages and all of that stuff. You kind of need to play the game. But one of the things that I find very useful recently was that the chargeback thing exists and it works. So I'm going on a stag do, or a couple of stag do's next this year now, but one of them, I booked the flight and I booked it with Wizz Air, and I knew it was taking a bit of a risk because Wizz Air are famously horrendous. But I was like, look, everybody else is going from Stansted. Fuck getting to Stansted from South London. I'm going to go from Gatwick. I'll arrive like 40 minutes before them, but that's fine. Or maybe it was like an hour before them, an hour or two before them. But that's fine because, you know, I'm expecting to be delayed because it's Wizz Air. But I can go from Gatwick and it's in the middle of the afternoon. It's like lunchtime. Perfect. Very easy for me. It's a little bit more expensive, but not. It's like 15 quid more expensive one way. But I'll pay that for the convenience. And then even if it's delayed 2 hours, I'll still be arriving around the same time as them. Then I booked it. And like 3 weeks afterwards, they sent me an email being like, by the way, we've changed your flight. Your flight now departs at 6 a.m. Which means I would get there like 8 hours before everybody else.
Oh my God.
And they were like, your options are to accept a new flight, book a new flight with us for free, or request a refund. And I was like, right, you know what? Fuck that. I'll just book a new flight. I'll just whatever. Like the whole point of this was convenience, and now it's not convenient because I need to leave the house at like 3 a.m. or coming up to 4. So I went through the whole thing, clicked the request refund button, and then I got like an error message saying, we can't process your request right now. Try again later. Why don't you just book another flight or accept this flight? These are your options. These are available now. We'll try and process your refund request later, or you can just keep your money in our company. Like very deliberately making it difficult for you to get your money back out of the company. They also have no real substantial customer service. Like there's nothing you can do about it. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, do I just accept that I've lost 90 quid on a flight that I'm not going to go on now? And I tried a couple of days later to do the same thing, kept getting the same error message. And I was like, fuck it, I booked it on a credit card. I'm just going to go to Amex. Went to Amex, talked to someone, and I was like, they were like, okay, yeah, sure, leave it with us. I would say 6 days later, they sent me a message being like, oh yeah, by the way, you'll be credited the cost of that flight on your next bill, on your next statement. We sorted it out. We've just told them that we're taking the money back off them. And I literally didn't have to do anything. The alternative would be me trying to find, hunt down like fucking Liam Neeson and Taken, some customer service assistant who would talk to me and be like, okay, yeah, okay, we'll process your refund. And they said in their emails, like, they're obligated to provide me a refund if I wish, because they've moved my flight more than like, I think it's 4 or 6 hours. So I was like legally allowed to request a refund and they had to process it. And they just made it so difficult, intentionally difficult, because they're a fucking horrendous company.
Yeah. But, and they always hope that you'll give up.
Yeah. Well, it was clearly like everything was set up that there were so many hurdles just to get to anywhere or to try anything that they hope their intention is, okay, fuck it, I'll just book a new flight, or I'll just accept the flight that you've changed it to and just get up at 3 a.m. and sit in Krakow Airport for 6 hours on my own waiting for the other people to arrive. And I was like, fuck that. But if I'd have booked it on a debit card, I wouldn't really have any leg to stand on. Whereas credit cards offer this chargeback option where you can basically go to them, complain about the quality of service or the provision of service that you've paid for, or general malpractice on the company that you've bought from, and then they go and fight it on your behalf as like a fucking huge credit card company corporation who can kind of basically do what the fuck they want, which is an issue in itself. But
well, and of course, it's not actually like money coming out of your account.
No,
you know.
They basically just, well, yeah, they I spent 90 quid on the flights with Wizz Air, and then my statement this month is 90 quid less than it would have been.
Yeah.
And it's just, for me, I am at a net zero, which is exactly what I wanted. Whoever, if Amex lose the money or if Wizz Air lose money, I don't give a fuck. But the fact that I just sent them one message and one screenshot, and then they just went and did it, and like a week later, they just gave me confirmation being like, yeah, we sorted it, don't worry. Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
That's good, man. Well, again, it's kind of in that same thing when I talked about changing internet, right? When you think there's actually a thing that's working for the consumer, it feels like it's so vanishingly rare that it's a pleasure when it happens.
Yeah.
I didn't really know where to go this week. I'm allowed to use my hand again. Not
I can
fully.
See you got plaster, though.
I can't lift weights. That's because I cut my finger. But I can lift my kids, which is pretty great. And also my kids are starting to play together. So they come home from nursery. Well, Goldie comes home from nursery. Coco's home from school. And they play together. And I just sit and watch. And I'm roped in. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I'm not. And it's incredible. It's and also just to watch them talking to each other. Like Goldie walks around and she says, come here, Cacao. Come here, Cacao. And Coco says, Goldie! Like they just like screech at each other like little gannets. Mm. But so that's pretty good. But I think what I'm going to put in is outdoor equipment. No, rather what I'm taking out is outdoor equipment rather.
Okay, that could be many things.
So you know that I love to buy clothes.
Yes.
But Pete.
So when you said that, I heard bike loads and I was like, I didn't know you were a cyclist.
I will never bike at all, let alone loads.
I lost a ton of respect for you instantaneously there. Yeah,
I'm calling it now. I will not get on a moving bike. I'll get on a stationary bike.
Yes, like a gym bike.
But I will not get on a moving bike in my life. I will never do it again. I just simply will not. But anyway, something I've signed up to do. So my dad is doing a charity walk.
Oh, okay, right. I know where you're going now.
In the Lesser Himalayas next April 2027. And I've signed up to do it too. So it's to raise money for a hospice. It's a hospice in Hull where my parents live, but they also have connections to a bunch of community centers and children's homes and hospices in India. And so I've signed up to do this trip as well. So we fly out to Delhi. We're in Delhi for a couple of days where we do 2 days of community work. So in the past, that's been building a playground at a children's home, painting bedrooms, you know, just doing helpful stuff. Mm-hmm. Then you get an overnight sleeper train up to Dharamsala and then you do this 5-day trek through the mountains. And it's going to be really nice. I need to raise a fuck ton of money. I need to raise like $4,000. But you know, $4,000 for charity, not to pay fees. So I will.
Oh, okay. There's like a threshold for you to be on that as a charitable.
Yeah. Because person, it costs them. I mean, I think some of that does cover the cost because I'm only paying like a few hundred quid. And so it's expensive for them to put on even with the work we're going to do. Yeah. So whatever. But, I will definitely be posting a page at some point, you know, a GoFundMe or a Just Giving or something for this. But what it's done, Pete, is it's opened up a whole new world of shit to buy. I need to buy some good walking shoes.
Yeah.
Because we are going to walk a long way at high altitude.
Well, actually, you did say that your Blundstones are perfect for any occasion.
I reckon I could do it in Blundstones. I just think it's ill-advised. Yeah. But you know, man, if you made me do it tomorrow, if you said tomorrow, you know, you have to start and you're going to walk, you know, for 8 hours a day for the next 5 days.
Yeah.
I'd be between my running shoes and my Blundstones.
I think the running shoes would give out within a couple of days.
You think? It depends how hard the terrain is. But yeah, anyway, so I need to buy some good walking shoes. Mm-hmm. I need to invest in base layers and a mid layer and probably a new waterproof layer. Do I have anything made with Gore-Tex? No, I don't. Will I at the end of this? You bet your ass I will.
What's the weather going to be like, though?
They said, you know, you can get a silk lining for your sleeping bag. And I was like, I didn't know that. But now you've given me that information.
Well, because of all your 4C chest hair.
I would, in fact, like to live deliciously. I haven't actually thought about my chest hair. I might create so much static charge that I would set fire to something. But so there's so much shit to buy. And so I'm sitting there. When I get a spare few minutes, I'm looking up merino wool base layers, Pete. I'm looking up, you know, what are the vents like on this particular waterproof? Should I get a lining bag to go inside my backpack to keep everything dry in there? How do I optimize? Because obviously there's a limit to how much I can carry. Then there'll be bigger packs will be taken from stop to stop on pack animals. Sure. So when we get there, they'll have set a tent up and, you know, dug a latrine and shit.
It's a real gentrified hike.
No. I mean, well, I think you're still pissing a hole.
Yeah, but if somebody's popping your tent up and digging the hole for you.
Yeah, but it's still a tent, you know. When the soldiers turned up at the front line in the First World War, you think they were just like, well, somebody's already dug the trench for us. This is fucking luxury. No, they still got trench foot died.
Yeah, but nobody's shitting at you.
I don't think if you asked me to put up a tent, I could put up a tent. It's not that fancy. Sure. When you say it's fancy, it makes it sound like there are going to be showers. They said there will be a bowl of water in the morning for you to refresh yourself. And if you go past a stream, you may bathe in it. And I was like, oh, fucking whoopee-doo. Like that sounds wonderful. I for one, cannot wait to bathe in mountain water at 3,000 meter altitude. I really want to do that.
What's the weather going to be like? What's the environment?
Oh, okay, so that's the funniest bit of it. they sent these documents. They said, so when you're in Delhi, temperatures are likely to be 28 to 33.
Yeah, and probably very humid.
But they said on the walk, temperatures probably peak at 28 in the day, but they can get down to zero at night. It may be very, very dry. It may rain. So they said, be prepared for all eventualities. And so I was like, I'm sorry, what? Like, so I'm going to go there and you're going to say to me, anything that can happen, any weather yeah. that happens on Earth, be prepared for that. So it might piss it down, might be dry, might actually be really quite hot, might be cold as fuck. You've just got to be prepared for anything that can happen. So I don't like that part of it. But on the other hand, Pete.
Well, you need to be prepared.
That means buying more shit.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to buy some more shit. So that's where I am at the moment. So yeah, I'm going to buy a Gore-Tex, you know, top layer. I'm going to really invest in some good base layers. I'm going to have to start walking all the fucking time because, you know, it's one thing to get fit and I'll be going to the gym and I'll be running as normal by the time I go.
Completely.
But at the same time, they said you really need to, at least several times before you come, you should have back-to-back days of walking several hours because that's what it's going to be like. You know, when you get to day three, day four, just and you've got to get up and walk another yeah. 8 hours, you need to know that you can do that. And
just
I thought, well, I know
like muscles in general, like your skeletal system is.
And just, it, I think it, as well, like the will so to go on, it's just so different. Especially at altitude, right?
Yeah.
You know, at altitude, you're just like, oh, fuck this. Like, let me go home. But I'll be with my dad as well, who will just kind of march on. So that'll help a bit.
How old
but
is that?
He will be 71 this year. So it'll be 71 when we go. But my dad's pretty fit. Mm. I remember when I was at uni, during one of the summer vacations, I got a chin-up bar and installed it, you know, in the doorway of my bedroom.
Yeah, yeah.
And my dad walked over and he said, what's this? What have you put up in the doorway of your bedroom? And I said, it's a chin-up bar. My dad said, what's a chin-up? And I showed him what a chin-up was. And my dad just repped out 10. He just got up. And he's a very petite man,
yeah.
you know, and he just gardens all the time.
Yeah.
But I was just like... That is I was like, that's bullshit behavior. Yeah, yeah. It was actually
Jesus is lifting up the boat.
When I did 10 chin-ups, it was then that Jesus carried me.
Yeah.
Jesus is underneath him, just yeah. fucking lifting
just
his legs.
David Goggins.
Yeah. yeah. So, but I was like, you do realize that some people train for months to be able to do
yeah,
chin-ups.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
not even 10 in a row, like 2.
And you've never tried a chin-up before and you've just done it. That is obscene behavior. But yeah, he's in pretty good shape. But at the same time, you know, he'll be 71 this year and I will probably not get a chance to do something like this with my dad again, which is why I'm doing it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Even though there is the part of me as a luxury boy that is like, and will there be face wash? At the camps that we stop at?
Yeah.
Will it be foaming?
Will I have to bring my own keels or will keels be provided for me?
Do you have salicylic acid?
Yeah.
though I did say to Emma the other day, they say that, you know, obviously if you need the loo during the hike, you just like go off the trail and have piss, whatever.
Mm.
And I was like, but are there snakes in this motherfucker?
Yeah.
Because I don't mind that part of it. But if there are snakes there, I'm not going to enjoy that. Fortunately, I guess because it's in the mountains, it'll be cooler. So I suppose things like snakes are a bit less common. They tend
also,
to be
I don't think you need to
places,
venture that far off the track. Just be like, you know, basically sure. stand on the edge of it and face the other way.
That's what you do. You just shit right next to the path, wouldn't you, Pete?
Well, I was talking about pissing, but yeah. Yeah, but yeah. Feces is a bit different, I guess.
Oh my God. Okay, well, look, let's move on to what we're putting in the burn book.
Yeah.
I'm going to do mine quickly.
Sure.
I went and saw Hamnet a couple of weeks ago with Emma and I really liked it. I didn't love it as much as I loved, you know, Sinners or One Battle After Another or whatever, but I thought it was really good. There are issues I have with it. You can check out my letterbox to see those. But there seems to have been this weird response to it where people say, oh, it's so manipulative. It's trying to make you cry. And I think, I don't really know how you do a film about a child dying that doesn't
intentionally do that, yeah.
like make you cry. I mean, how should they treat that matter? But it just seems weird to engage with art that way, to think, oh, how dare they try and make me feel emotions? what do they think they're doing? Especially because
how dare they try and stir things inside me?
I will see people say this on Letterboxd and I will go to their profile to see what their top 4 films are. And they'll have like Good Will Hunting in there. And I think, oh yeah, Good Will Hunting, that's a film that doesn't try to make you cry at all. Good Will Hunting just lets you feel whatever you're feeling on that particular day. It doesn't make any sense. All films are trying to make you feel something. of course, some films can be manipulative about it, but this is a film, it's not just chucking stuff in to make you feel bad. The subject matter of the film is the death of a child.
Yeah.
And if the film the treats
name,
that...
It's named after the child.
Yes, and the film treats that topic seriously. There's if you want it not to be upsetting, then you are asking for the film not to exist. Oh, this Holocaust drama was actually really disturbing. They're just trying to disturb me.
Yeah.
No, that's in the nature of the subject matter. It is disturbing and you should be disturbed by it. And being uncomfortable at art is also one of the points of art. It's not just there to, you know, to lull you to sleep as you watch fucking season 4 of Friends for the 10th time. It just seemed like a really weird reaction to it. I think I have actual issues with things in that film, but I would like people to be able to articulate their actual issues rather than just, it made me feel feelings and I didn't care for it. That I didn't actually consent to that or some bullshit, I don't know. So a fan of the way that people are engaging with art at the moment. So that's what I'm putting in the burn book.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Like, you wouldn't have somebody go to a horror film and be like, didn't expect it to be scary.
This hot sauce that you put on my food, you're just trying to make my tongue tingle.
Yeah.
Why have you done that? What do you mean?
I love the accent you do whenever you imitate like a dumb person. It's always that accent.
It's my dimwit voice. My dimwit voice. I think if I spent 5 minutes, I'd probably be able to trace it to a particular boy at school.
Oh, really?
Almost certainly, yeah. There were a lot of those guys at school who just kind of talked like that.
Yeah. Fair.
What are you talking about?
It's always the same accent.
Yeah, same accent. Anyway, right. What are you putting in the burn book?
What I'm putting in the burn book is time. I'm not a fan of it.
You're not fucking out. All right, Stephen Hawking. I guess he's like the ultimate fan of time.
Yeah, not a fan of time. And I've been feeling this recently for a few weeks because Bonnie is approaching one. She's one in a couple of weeks.
That is nuts.
Which is just insane to me because it seems like it was yesterday that she was born, and she's literally going to be, we're going to have a 1-year-old in like 2 weeks from now. And it just made me really think about like time and basically all of the life stuff that's happening. And I'm 35, right in the middle of 30 and 40 seems to be the decade of like the big movement decade, like the decade where the shit happened, generally speaking. You know, the decade that you probably get married and have kids and maybe buy a house, all of those other things, like all of the big things in life that have a huge impact on the rest of your life seem generally to happen some between like very late 20s, probably 30, through to about 40. You know, big career moves, all that stuff. You're kind of setting yourself up for the rest of your life in your 30s and 40s. So I think there's like, it feels a bit like a relentless battleground at times in that there's so much going on. But there's moments I've had in the past 6 months or so, and maybe it's kind of just post-paternity leave when I went back to work, where I've been like basically dangling the carrot in front of me, saying like, it's a bit set to Wednesday afternoon and be like, oh, just need to get to the weekend. Just get to the weekend. Or I've got like a holiday coming up in 2 weeks and I'm like, oh, just need to get through these 2 weeks now I'm on holiday. And I find myself almost wishing time away. And that has created this weird like conflict within me because on the one hand, time has never passed so quickly. Or it feels like it's never passed so quickly. This year, this first year of that Bonnie's existed has just disappeared.
Yeah.
But also with it has come more stresses, more responsibility, more things to do. Life becomes more relentless, and it's all completely worth it. But I have found myself getting scenarios when I'm sitting in work on a Wednesday afternoon, being like, "Fuck, I just need these next like 2.5 days to be over." And then I get into this weird relationship about being, I want to be present, and I don't want to wish time away, but also like sometimes it's tough. So yeah, I don't like how quickly time is going and how quickly time is passing. I don't like the relationship I have with time at the minute. Because too often I feel like I just want to get through certain days and almost like throw them to the side as like meaningless days almost.
Yeah. And then you're like, I've had exactly the same thought.
Yeah.
And then you think, when am I waiting for life to get good?
Yeah.
Like, and when do I imagine that will happen?
There's something I saw a few weeks ago where it was basically somebody probably in their 80s talking about what they're basically just talking about how they would give anything to go back to like 35 and like see their younger face and their kids would still be small and little and special. And it would just be like a shitty Tuesday where their two kids are like fighting and they're just trying to get out of the house and all. And something that seems so stressful and difficult and annoying and frustrating at the time. 50 years later, when you're looking back on it, you're like, it was incredible. And it was like something that I wished I was more present in. And I wished that I didn't wish it away so much as I did. And it's kind of difficult to see it when it's so near to you and you're so involved and immersed in it. But yeah, there was a whole spiel that this person said about basically how all of the things in their like 30s that felt terrible or difficult or challenging and frustrating at the time, now that they're in their 80s, they'd be like, I take that back in a heartbeat because it was so special. But they had a much greater appreciation for it. So I've been kind of battling with that for the last couple of weeks to try and be more appreciative and present. And when it gets difficult, to just kind of not wish it away, because this year has absolutely disappeared. Like, absolutely disappeared. It feels like it's been about 3 months.
Yeah.
And it's just insane. And I think everybody speaks about how their young children grew up so quickly. And I guess, it's not that I didn't believe them. It's just that when you don't have anything to compare it to, or any real world experience of it, it's hard to really kind of understand it. But this year has just gone.
Yeah, I do get that. Like, it is, and sometimes you just think, I just need everything to get very slightly easier. You know, when it gets very slightly easier, then I'll be happy. And then, yeah, you think, well, I am then just hoping to skip through three
fast
good
forward,
months.
Like, yeah.
You're like, oh, well, then it will be easy. No, I feel the same way. And I think it's a really hard thing to try and actually enjoy your life in the moment. Like, it's incredibly difficult, because it quite often feels like, I'll do this job, I'll get through this hard thing, and after that, I will be able to relax and, you know, have a nice day. And you get to that point and there's another job that comes up and, you know, you're still not really there. So, yeah, this is something I struggle with as well. I think it's a really tough one. So, yeah, it's a good one. Okay, right. I think that brings us to a close for the public episode. Thank you for being here, everybody. We will catch a bunch of you over on the paid side. We'll be answering some of your questions. Please continue to get your questions in for future episodes, and we will see you next time on Unseen Incidents. Bye.